Welcome to Three Women, Three Ways. We have an interview today with Victoria Banyard. Victoria, welcome.
Thanks.
Okay. The reason that we're talking with Victoria Banyard, she's an academic and a researcher, and we're talking about campus assault. Victoria, tell me, please, your background. Why are you interested in campus assault, and what does that mean?
Well, I think there are a number of different definitions of that, but probably the one that's, you know, most talked about right now is campus sexual assault, because of the alarming statistics that students, particularly women students, report. You know, as many as 1 in 5, 1 in 4 women will report having experienced a sexual assault or some forms of unwanted sexual conduct contact while they're on campus. We also know that sexual assault is a form of trauma that has very negative consequences for people who experience it. Many people who study campus sexual assault are also interested in other forms of assault that happen on campuses, particularly the forms of interpersonal violence like intimate partner violence or dating violence, which can be more physical and emotional, and just really how, you know, campuses are a place where people are going to forge a better future and to learn and grow and change. And these are the kinds of things which, when they happen on campuses, can really get in the way of that.
Okay. That makes sense. But I think that we have changed the definition of sexual assault, haven't we? It seems that way to me anyway. I mean, it used to be when somebody talked about sexual assault, they weren't talking about just inappropriate touch. They were talking about actual sexual rape or, you know, something that was really egregious. Today, we tend to lump all unwanted touch or unwanted contact together. Is that helpful or does that hinder people's empathy and understanding of sexual assault?
Well, the research that's been done on sexual assault, and there's been a huge body of research that has focused on defining it and measuring it and understanding how it happens. And really that research has pointed to the notion that sexual assault is really best understood as a continuum of interconnected types of violations, coercion, and problematic behavior. So that, and there are different compartments or forms of sexual violence that, and so people tend to use that term like sexual violence as a way of talking about that broader construct and talking about the fact that there are lots of different kinds of behaviors that can be unwanted and that can be perceived very negatively and have very negative effects. I think mostly when people use the term sexual assault, they are talking about rape, they are talking about sort of the most invasive form of sexual abuse where someone forces someone else to have sexual intercourse against their will using coercion or other tactics. But I think really in the research literature, we talk very much about how sexual violence is best seen as a continuum with, on the one hand, harassing comments all the way up through unwanted touching, and then different forms of unwanted sexually intimate behaviors.
It seems to me that a lot of times people tend to minimize sexual assault, or, you know, especially at that, you know, lower end of the continuum. But is it, I mean, it seems logical to me that somebody, you know, grabbing someone's body part and moving on would not be as traumatic as somebody who, as a woman who experienced actual, you know, penetration or sexual assault, as we define it by rape. But are there repercussions? Are there lingering repercussions for women at all ends of that spectrum? Or, you know, I mean, I was talking to a man the other day who was saying, well, you know, get over it. And I thought,
the research is really clear. Yeah, so I think the research is really clear that, and the reason why we've come to this notion of a continuum is really the idea that all of those unwanted behaviors across the continuum can create very negative consequences. So, you know, I think that it's really difficult to sort of objectively and being outside the situation and not walking in someone's shoes to say whether their experience was as bad or less bad than someone else's. I mean, I feel like that's who are we to judge that, right?
Yes, exactly. That
they understand their own experiences, and I think we need to believe them when they say that something has a negative impact on them. And the research is also very clear that whether we're talking about harassing comments in the workplace or on the street, or we're talking about unwanted groping at a party, or we're talking about someone trying to force themselves sexually on someone else using threats, or that all of those things have been shown to have negative consequences for the people who experience them. So I think that's really where the continuum approach or framework has come from.
Okay. And I think that that's a reasonable approach to take to it. I know that sometimes I'm just going to play devil's advocate here. How bad is it if you're at a party, everybody's drinking, and somebody grabs your rear end, as opposed to walking down the street, going home from the library, and being pulled into an alley and sexually assaulted and raped? On that continuum, I don't even know how to phrase this. I'm trying to, what am I trying to get to here, Victoria? Help me out. I'm trying to.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, Heather, I don't know that I can really speak to that, because I think that my answer is that what we know from the research is that there are negative repercussions of all of those things. And who are we as the outsiders to say that there's some objective, this experience would be bad or this experience wouldn't be bad? I mean, all of those things are violating your personal autonomy, right? And your own ability to choose
exactly
what happens to your body. So I think that I don't really know where to go. And that's really my area of research. I mean, more, you know, the work I've done is you sort of start by believing people and you start by asking them about what impact that has on them. And what people tell us is that all of those things have negative impacts on their well-being, on their sense of safety in the world, on their ability to achieve their personal goals, and that when those things happen in the context of places like a workplace or places like a campus where you're supposed to be learning, and that those experiences interfere with being able to focus on your learning and be able to be successful as a student. So I think that, I guess I would say that, you know, we really need to be looking across that full spectrum, and I'm not really sure I can speak to like what is worse than the other. I mean, we do know, for example, that if you look across people's lifespan, that oftentimes people have more than one traumatic thing happen to them, which is kind of a whole different topic. But, you know, we know from that cumulatively, if you have more different types of traumatic events that happen to you, then that is going to put you at risk for, you know, mental health effects and distress and those kinds of things. But, I think it's really hard to sort of compare and say this particular trauma is the same or worse or less, I think, because people have their lived experience. And I think that's a problem when we don't listen to people's lived experience.
Okay. So what I'm hearing you say is, I have a friend who at the end of her email, she always says, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I always think, no, what doesn't kill you this time might kill you next time. Is that what you're saying, that, you know, it depends on the person? You know, this whole notion that you go through traumas and it toughens you up and then you can handle more isn't necessarily true?
Well, I think it's complicated because we're talking about human beings. So I think that the research does suggest that if you're exposed to more adversity, that's going to take a toll on your physical and mental health. But another line of my research is on resilience, and it really shows the incredible strengths that people bring to bear in spite of very difficult situations. So again, I think that just because someone's experienced something, we also don't want to just assume that they're never going to recover from it. I mean, people are incredibly strong, and survivors are incredibly strong and moving forward in their lives. But nonetheless, we still would prefer, I think, as a society, to not have people have to go over those kinds of bumps on their way to reaching their goals. You know, it would be better if they didn't have to deal with that. And so I think it's just a good question, but it's complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, most things are, aren't they? We try to make things simple, and try to get that slogan that we can live by, but it depends on the person, and it depends on the situation, and it depends on the history, and all of those, so many it depends upon. So I apologize for trying to ask you and put you on a spot, but that's human nature. We want things spelled out very clearly for us, and sometimes it's not able to be that way. Yeah. Well, let's get back to the whole notion of sexual assault. I was talking to, I did an interview yesterday with a woman at a campus, near campus in California. And she said that this very renowned school had a sexual assault rate of about 40% for women. And I went, wow, 40%? Is that just an anomaly, or is that consistent with the numbers that you see of reported sexual assaults?
Well, I think the issue is that it's really hard to get very accurate numbers about the percentage of people who experience a sexual assault in any given time frame, because it's still very hard for survivors to come forward and to talk about what's happened. So I think getting really, so we know that it is a vastly underreported crime. And what we also know, and we're starting to see with more of the campus sexual violence surveys that are out there in the field and that people are doing on campuses, is that there's a lot of variability. So I think, you know, people talk about that average figure of 25% or 1 in 4, but there's, as with everything else, there are probably some campuses that are above that, and there are likely some campuses that are below that. So, yes. And I
well,
think
and it all depends on what's reported, right? I mean, it could be that campuses in some geographic areas, the women don't necessarily report it as much or something, depending on cultural norms or whatever. I mean, all of these numbers are based on what's reported, right?
Well, they're based, it depends, right? So some of the research reports official statistics, meaning what's been reported to formal helpers at Title IX offices or law enforcement. The campus climate surveys tend to use confidential or anonymous surveying techniques, and those tend to produce higher rates because people aren't being identified, so they will often feel more comfortable talking about things that have happened to them. But again, it also depends when you talk about numbers, getting back to your earlier point that you started the interview with, which is that how we define sexual assault and sexual violence makes a really big difference in terms of our numbers, so that we can certainly see campuses taking a very conservative numerical counting approach. Probably the most conservative approach is reporting the numbers of sexual assaults that have been reported to law enforcement or Title IX, right? That's going to give you the smallest number, and most campuses are going to look like there isn't a lot of it going on. Once you get into more of the confidential or anonymous surveying, that's when you start to get these higher numbers. And again, it depends on when they're reporting that statistic, if they're including the full continuum of unwanted sexual experiences, or if they're really narrowly defining it as more of rape, unwanted penetration, like those kinds of behaviors only. So even within one campus, you might get very different statistics depending on how big a bucket you're making it in terms of defining sexual assault and sexual violence.
Well, that makes it sound like it's very difficult to get a real accurate picture of what's going on, and yet the statistics seem to be, we seem to think that this is going on at all campuses, but with those variations, is it difficult to really get a handle on how much of this is going on in general on college campuses?
I think to echo your earlier point about how everybody wants like the right, the one kind of more simple answer, I guess I would say it's very difficult to get a very hard and fast, simple answer to that question, but it's not hard to know the scope of what's going on. So when you look at some of the original research that was done developing one of the most widely used instruments to assess sexual violence. It was developed by Dr. Mary Koss and in the late 1980s. And, you know, it's very behaviorally specific. And starting then, campuses have been doing these studies. And when researchers do these studies, over time, we're still seeing an average figure of around, say, 25%, right? So that tells us that in general, we're probably zeroing in on a kind of a general percentage that gives us an idea that this is a pretty big problem, because, I don't know, one in four sounds like a lot of people to me. But in terms of trying to pinpoint for any one campus, you know, there, yes, it's tricky, but I think with these campus climate surveys and things that people have been using with the newer behaviorally specific measures, people can start to get an idea of the scope of the problem. And you know, one of the other things that, again, the research is super clear about is that most campuses, when you do a sexual violence survey, come up with much higher numbers than you get if you just look at official reports. And so, again, we can kind of see that disconnect in terms of who's willing to report formally and how much of this we really think is going on.
You mentioned that these studies and the, you know, trying to seek out the actual, you know, what's actually happening there on campuses started in the 80s. Have we seen a change? Has there been a change in the trend or in the numbers, or has it been pretty consistent?
So overall in the research, the numbers are pretty consistent. Now, in the 1980s, we were not attending to campus sexual assaults in the way that we are now. So I do think that there's a lot of work that's being done on campuses across the world to try to reduce numbers of sexual assaults. But I think we don't yet have a lot of those patterns of data. What we have since the 1980s are research studies that have been done. And those numbers keep coming up pretty consistently to suggest that we haven't really solved the problem. But then on the other hand, we've really only had this issue rise to the level of attention that it's been getting really, really recently, like, you know, less than 10 years. So that's not a lot of time to be really shifting and changing. And it's really only been in the last 5 years or so that campuses have begun to really use surveys and things to try to understand the scope of the problem. And I think as we see more and more of that continue to happen, if campuses continue to do this work that they've started, that those campuses will have the numbers to be able to look at whether rates are going up and down on their campus and how that might be related to the work they're doing. So I think hopefully okay. We'll have some answers to that in the future.
Good. Let's move away from the whole idea of the statistics and the frequency and the prevalence and all that stuff, and let's talk about what's being done about it. Are campuses responding to this? I would think that they are responding a heck of a lot more now than they did, say, 10 years ago, simply because of simply because we're talking about it. But that's my assumption. Are campuses really doing anything to address this issue? And if so, what?
Yes, they are. And a lot of this, I mean, many campuses have been thinking about this for a long time, but I think it really got on the national stage in April of 2011 with the Dear Colleagues letter that came out of Office of Civil Rights, Department of Education, really trying to clarify some of the Title IX guidance and talking about sexual assault as a piece of considerations related to Title IX. That was followed up with the formation by former President Obama of the White House Task Force to Protect Students from Sexual Assault, which focused quite a lot on college campuses and provided resources and, you know, a lot of awareness and, you know, really kind of put this issue on the national stage. And this is where I'm not a policy person, so I can't get into the weeds about this, but there have also been some policy shifts, right, through the Violence Against Women Act, Campus Save Act, that are also, you know, through things like Title IX, giving some specifics to campuses about what they need to be doing. And so I think all of this came together, especially with the White House Task Force, to really, and then also with the Office of Civil Rights really, you know, investigating campuses where there were allegations that sexual assaults were being mishandled. And so we saw a lot of that in the media as well. And so I think campuses really, it was a moment to really, for them to really look and say, what are we doing about this? And so I think campuses are really, many campuses are using a multi-pronged approach to try to address this. And on the one hand is the response side, right, which includes policies that are clear and student conduct procedures that address these problems on campus. It also includes campuses having services for victims, places where they can go for support and information available to them. And I think many campuses have been really working to make those more available to students, to get the word out about them. And then also campuses have really been thinking a lot about prevention. And we see a lot of campuses really working to try to put prevention strategies in place to keep these things from happening in the first place, which is, I really think, where we need to be going, because once someone's been harmed, once these kinds of incidents happen, it's just, the outcomes are terrible, right? People have been hurt and systems are imperfect. And if we could keep more of these incidents from happening in the first place, we could just let students be students and work on their academic and career goals and let campuses do the work that they were set up to do, really. So,
yeah. You know, one of the things, and maybe this isn't something you can answer, but one of the things that always amazes me is that when you hear of a campus assault and then the person reports it, the victim reports it to campus police, blah, blah, blah. Why? Why would they report it to campus police? Why wouldn't they just go straight to the city, the county, whatever? I don't understand why campus police are given that kind of role. I mean, if it were my daughter or if it were me, you know, forget the campus police. I'd go straight to the, you know, the state patrol, the county sheriff, whoever that designated authority is. Why do they rely so much on campus police?
So I think what you have to think about is from the perspective of the survivor, and I've actually worked with a number of colleagues on studies that have looked at this, including looking at the motivations that survivors have for reporting what happened to them to others. And a lot of times, the first thing they think of is not criminal justice. So, and again, there's as much variability in why people disclose as there are survivors. So I don't want to be like being overly general, but I will say that when you look and you interview and you talk to survivors or they fill out surveys about this disclosure process, many times the first thing that they want is support. So that's why they're much more likely to disclose to their friends first. Like that's the number one place they're likely to go. Even before they go to a crisis center, right? Is they're likely to tell a friend, tell a roommate.
Sure, that makes perfect sense, yeah.
Right. But if they're going to choose to go somewhere else, a lot of times it's to get some immediate needs taken care of. It's not to get the person arrested and prosecuted. Like, that's not always the first consequence or thing that survivors want to have happen. A lot of times, again, because campuses are small communities, a lot of times survivors know the person who has assaulted them. So they may just want to not have class with that person anymore if they're still in the same class. They may and likely are at first very, very worried about how their own classes are going to go. Even if their perpetrator is not in their classes, they're students, they have scholarships, they have goals. They're, you know, something very bad has happened to them, and they're trying to figure out, okay, how do I get some, maybe an extension on some of the papers that I need to write in my classes so that I can continue to be a successful student. So a lot of times their first line of engagement is with campus services, right? And those are organized on campuses in lots of different ways, but campus police is one entryway for some of those campus-based resources, which can often be the first thing that survivors might think about just to try to get their immediate going on with their life stuff, in order. I think the other piece is that campuses and student conduct systems, they're not the criminal justice system, right? So that's not the place to go to establish if this person has committed a crime against a state law or federal law, right, like about, you know, a sexual assault. It's a place, but it is a place where a student can be given other kinds of consequences, can be removed from campus for some period of time, can be mandated to switch classes so that they're no longer in class with the person who's accused them of wrongful behavior. So I think the campus system is really different. And so sometimes survivors might choose to go to campus first because they want to activate a campus system, not a big out-in-the-community law enforcement system. And honestly, a lot of times people just don't know the difference. So it's very confusing. Like, sometimes it's even confusing for me to understand all the different ins and outs of policy because I'm a researcher, I'm not a policy person. And yet we're asking our students to try to make those kinds of decisions at a very, very stressful time in their lives. And oftentimes, because campuses work hard on this, right, like many, many campuses work to have their campus security be in the community, be available to students, see them perhaps more, given students' experiences, perhaps as more trustworthy as community law enforcement, who they may not know, or who, you know, they may have had, or their community may have had negative experiences with law enforcement in the past. But on campuses, a lot of campuses really work hard for their campus security, their campus law enforcement to be available to students, to be known to students. And so that doesn't then seem so illogical if you're really in a very scared and in a very hard place that you might go to the place that seems most familiar or most potentially safe.
Are most colleges, again, there's been a lot of talk and a lot of action over the last several years bringing this to the forefront, but are most colleges prepared to handle things like that? Because, I mean, let's face it, it is a crime. It's a crime. It's not just a little offense. It's a crime. It's illegal.
So I think, I mean, I can't really speak because, like, this is where I'm a researcher, so I haven't done research on this. So I can't really speak to that, except that what I can speak to, just knowing campuses, is that they're not trying to treat, like, campus law enforcement works with community law enforcement, right? So if there is evidence of a crime that is a crime that would be prosecuted out in the community, the campus is working with the community around making that happen in the criminal justice system. Like, campuses are not trying to be the criminal justice system. They are trying to work with problems of student conduct that happen on their campus. I think campuses know that. I mean, that's what their Title IX offices are for. And there's lots of collaboration that happens between law enforcement and Title IX on campuses and those kinds of things. And I think, again, with the broader societal awareness, I can only imagine, though I can't speak to it because it's not my area of expertise, I can only imagine that this is an area of work that campuses are doing to try to get better at sorting through those collaborations and all of those kinds of procedures and policies and things like that.
Okay. Well, one of the things that you are a researcher or that you can speak to, I think, are remedies. What are some of the programs that are helping with this situation on campuses?
So prevention, as I was saying before, that's what I know, and I think that's also absolutely something that's often under-resourced, but that helps us get to a place where these things don't happen in the first place, right? So campuses are doing a lot in terms of prevention. I have been involved with colleagues on a number of studies looking at the effectiveness of a particular kind of prevention, which is bystander intervention training, or as I like to call them, actionists, right? Because usually when you hear the term bystander, people think, oh, people are standing by, they're not doing anything. So I like to use the term actionist. But many campuses, and there are a number of programs out there that have been researched, including bringing in the bystander, which is was developed by folks at the University of New Hampshire, where I used to work. Green Dot, which is developed by Dorothy Edwards, and Altruistic, which is a nonprofit that does prevention work. There are a variety of these forms of, here at Rutgers, we do iScream, which is interactive theater, which has a bystander component. And really the idea is to give everyone a role to play in sexual violence prevention and to really sort of say there are things that you can do, there are skills that you can build, there's a toolkit that you can have so that you can be in a situation and certainly think about your own safety, but think about not just doing nothing, but think about trying to step in to reduce the risk, or even if you're not in a risky situation, to be an influencer, to be someone who talks about healthy relationships and sexual violence prevention as a priority, someone who, you know, talks with friends before you go out on a weekend night to socialize about how you're going to have each other's backs to keep each other safe and things like that. So I think, and those programs are showing some promise. There's also a line of what has been talked about as resistance, refusal programming. And a colleague of mine, Charlene Fenn, who's actually in Canada, has been doing some amazing research on this, which is...
What does that mean? I'm not familiar with that. What does that mean?
Yeah, so it's pretty cool, actually, because the findings are that it really is having an impact on rates of victimization. Basically what it is, it's empowering in particular young women to have a set of strategies that both reduce any sort of self-blame that might happen if an assault were to happen to them, help give them some of those resources. And but it also teaches them resistance and refusal strategies, ways of safety planning, and having assertiveness and empowerment in terms of expressing one's needs when somebody is starting to encroach on your personal space. Now, these programs have sometimes been seen kind of negatively and for, you know, historically for some good reasons, in that just giving women self-defense classes, for example, without a lot of this sort of empowerment education can be seen as just asking for women to take on the burden of preventing sexual violence when the vast majority of perpetrators of sexual violence are men. So people have had some issues with that. But what I will say is that there's a number of researchers and practitioners, including Charlene Fenn, including Dr. Fitzgiddich in Ohio. A number of these folks have been developing and researching these programs that aren't just about it's all on you to do this. It's not that at all. It's very much of a culture change is going to take a long time. We need to keep working on it. But in the meantime, here's how you can reduce risk, feel empowered, have a voice. And here's also how if in the randomness of life, you end up getting targeted as a victim of this, how to not blame yourself, how to, you know, get resources and those kinds of things. So, and those things are showing promise. There's some other researchers. Dr. Testa in New York State has been doing some work with parents, which I think is really innovative. So training parents of rising college freshmen and giving them some handouts, some materials for discussing with their soon-to-be college students about sexual assault, about reducing risk, and about what the warning signs are, and about bystander, you know, being an actionist, and those kinds of things to empower parents to have important and helpful discussions with their children who are heading off to college campus, to model positive norms about, you know, this is not, using coercion in relationships is not something that is okay, and things like that. So I think we're seeing a lot of these kinds of innovative programs. Mentors in Violence Prevention out of Northeastern does a lot of work with athletes. I mean, they do work with college students in general, but they have had particular focus on college athletes, and I know are on a lot of campuses nationally and even internationally, working with college students and particularly with athletics in terms of about this bystander approach. So lots of good stuff happening out there.
If I can interrupt here, that's interesting to me because when I think of the most likely perpetrators, I think of the athletes, which is probably a rash assumption on my part, but it seems like whenever whenever I've heard of campus assault or whatever, those athletes seem to often be the perpetrators. So you're going, some of these programs are actually going to the athletes and suggesting that they become activists in prevention instead of, you know, the good old boy approach of the past. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I think part of that is that, you know, athletes on many campuses are some of the most high visibility students. So I think that's why we tend to, you know, they're the cases that often end up in the media, right? And so right. Certainly there are some studies that talk about some particular risk factors around sexual assault, both, that are related to college athletics. But I think the research is also that's been done also suggests that it's not just about membership in a particular group. It's more about the peer norms in that group and that there can be very different norms for behavior and attitudes across different teams as there can across different student organizations. And that it's probably more important to pay attention to that as a risk factor, sort of some of the peer norms that support using coercion and that kind of thing than just what group the student is part of. But I think what some of these programs like MVP and stuff are really trying to do, and Men Can Stop Rape in D.C. is doing a lot of work with college athletics as well. And I think some of that comes from the fact that college athletes are leaders on campus. And so from a bystander perspective, if we can get athletes trained in as actionists, they're huge influencers on the campus. If they come forward, we had one, colleagues of mine at UNH designed a social marketing campaign called Know Your Power, which is, you know, tries to model positive bystander intervention. And in some of the first iterations of the campaign on our campus, they had a well-known athlete who was interested in being in the posters, you know, and his face was on the side of campus buses and posted around dorms and dining halls and such. And, you know, that created a lot of opportunities where people would say, hey, I saw your picture and what's up with that campaign? And, you know, then he has the chance to say, well, let me tell you about it. Let me tell you about why I thought it was important to put my face on that poster, why I think this is an issue, you know, and that's sort of that setting of pro-social norms that can help counteract some of the cultural risk factors that lead to these high rates of sexual violence.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that I've seen and studied is that the more, for example, if an athlete has a bunch of sisters, or if any man has a bunch of sisters, somehow they tend to be a lot more empathetic and a lot more interested in preventing assaults against women, any women. I know that I can't quote a study on that, but I know I've seen that actually documented. Are you seeing that? Is that something where, you know, if an athlete already understands, you know, that any girl out there is somebody's daughter, somebody's sister, somebody's, you know, mother for that matter, are they more likely to want to participate in these kinds of prevention programs?
So that's a
or
good
did
question.
I ask you another
and
question?
That study hasn't really been done in terms of what are those leverage points that make someone go, I want to be part of that program. But we do know, and it is pretty much a part of a lot of prevention trainings, to create that connection to someone's lived experience. So to make it more relevant to their friends, their sisters, their, you know, what have you. So I think in general, that's kind of a teaching and learning strategy that I think is incorporated in a lot of these kinds of prevention initiatives. But I think that really where we need to go in the future is being able to dismantle and unpack a lot better what are the key pieces of these prevention strategies that are really hooking people in and speaking to them and getting them motivated to engage in prevention. We still don't have the answer to that. And it's, of course, really important because there's only 24 hours in a day, right? So we want to make our programs as effective as we can in as little time as we can.
Right. One of the things that bothers me as a mother and as a woman who also went to college, who also experienced a lot of things that young college girls experience, why are we, I think somewhere along the line we decided that if we talked about behavioral modifications for women, that we were in effect making them totally responsible for their sexual assault or making them responsible for somebody else's actions instead of, you know. But from a practical standpoint, I mean, why are we not emphasizing, or are we? You know, don't get drunk. Don't get blotto. And with both of my kids, I have a boy and a girl, with both of my kids, when they headed off to college, I said, don't do anything that makes you not be in control of yourself, because that's when trouble happens and that's when you get hurt. So whether it's, you know, whatever it is, don't get yourself in a position where you're no longer in control of yourself. And that seems to not be a very popular attitude. I mean, I've been criticized for that a couple of times. But to me, it makes sense. I mean, if I don't want my car to be stolen, I'm not going to park it unlocked with a key in it somewhere, you know, in a high crime rate area. To me, it just makes sense. But am I hopelessly old-fashioned here and blaming the victim and making the victim responsible? Explain this to me.
I mean, I think that we just have to be careful about the context of messages, right? So I think that for a long time, the only messages related to prevention were women, here's what you need to do to not get assaulted. And then young men, mm-hmm. here's what sexual assault is, don't do it, right? And if those are really the only messages that are coming down the street, then first of all, they're really pretty limited and they don't really work. But like, especially for young women, if that message is don't be a victim, it does set up and help to reinforce the already huge amount of self-blame that survivors have when this happens, because they say, well, if only I wasn't. And then, of course, it's reinforced by the questions people ask, like, well, what time were you walking at night? Well, what were you doing at that party? Don't you know that's not a good place to go? Like, all of a sudden, you know, there's this phenomenon in psychology called the just world hypothesis, right? This idea that we want the world to be okay. And so if something not okay happens to somebody and we look at them and they kind of seem like us and creates a lot of anxiety, like, oh my gosh, you know, maybe that could happen to me. And so we start looking around to try to create something that makes them different, because then maybe, oh, well, they did that thing and I would never do that, so then this won't happen to me. Like, it's a sort of a self-protective strategy. So I think the issue is just what's the package of messages that are coming out. So I think, and she could, of course, speak to her work so much more eloquently than I am, but to go back to Dr. Sen's work, I think, you know, in hearing her talk about her work, she does teach young women self-protective strategies, and she teaches them resistance strategies and how to be empowered to say what you want when you are with someone and what you don't want and all of those kinds of things. But she also combines that with a lot of messaging around there are points at which you don't have any control over this and you can't blame yourself. And so it's a richer and more nuanced kind of package of prevention messages. Actually, I was part of a large team of researchers who just wrote an article about this, and where we really talked about how you need to be doing all of these things. The campuses should be doing bystander intervention that says everyone has a role to play, and then perhaps offering some of these refusal training skills. And then also, you know, there's another body of prevention that really talks a lot about gender norms around masculinity and how some of those kinds of things that are culturally passed down from one generation to another put some young men at risk for being perpetrators of sexual violence. And that if we start to package all of those things up together, then we can have those more nuanced conversations, because it's not the only prevention message that's coming down the street.
And I think that that's very crucial, that it not be the only message, but I think it's important that it be part of the message. You know, I mean, to me, any time you do something where you're not in control and you're not thinking clearly, you're at risk of something, whether you're behind the wheel of a car or whether you're, you know, in wherever. I mean, to me, it just makes sense. And so, I appreciate you saying that it should be part of a package, and I agree with that totally. But I do think that it should be part of the package to tell people.
Yeah, I mean, I
people,
think it's just really tricky, because what's also really tricky and a slippery slope about that, which is also I think why people have a negative response to it, is that sort of none of these lessons are context free. And we're in a society, sadly, that still in 2018 constantly blames victims, constantly asserts that they false report, constantly feels that they must be making it up or that somehow they brought this on themselves. And so I think that it's also much harder to try to have a conversation around risk reduction, which is sort of what you're trying to talk about there. It's very hard to do that absent all of this other cultural conversation, because that's all there. And so I think that, my hope would be that we could keep moving along in some of these broader cultural messages, which are just so incredibly brutal towards survivors, so that we could have lots of different prevention conversation and that people would not have to feel blamed. But I think right now, rightly, lots of people do feel sort of blamed very easily, because there are so many messages societally that reinforce that.
Yeah. Well, and I agree. I mean, I'm of an age where, if a girl got raped, you shut your mouth, because especially if it was date rape, because clearly you did something that caused this and you weren't smart enough or you weren't that or you sent the wrong message. I mean, I'm well aware, of the history of this, but I also think that we're missing the boat if we don't include some of those self-prevention strategies some of those prevention strategies for young people themselves. And as I said, I include men as well as women. I mean, there are many young men who've been participated in something that they would never have participated in if they were in full control of themselves. That's just my thing, and I see that.
To your point, there's a huge and growing literature on the intersection of alcohol and sexual assault, and I think people really trying to look at those questions and try to think about how to combine across topics in prevention to really kind of enhance the messaging that's happening. So I think thinking about the both and of lots of different forms of risk and things that college students are dealing with is sort of how we're going to move ahead in thinking about prevention.
Our discussion wouldn't be complete if I don't ask you, what about male victims? Do all of these programs apply to male victims as well? Is it different for male victims of campus sexual assault? Is the definition different for male victims?
So campuses have services for male and female and LGBTQ and trans communities. I mean, I think that's one of the places that campuses have really been moving forward on, is really recognizing that survivors of sexual violence, it happens at all kinds of different ages and stages of life, that all kinds of different people are, experience this. And so I think that they're really working, the research is working to catch up, to understand more about the experiences of different groups. And then certainly the services and prevention are working to address that as well. I mean, that's one of the things from a bystander perspective that makes that form of prevention, I think, inherently appealing, which is that it really gives everyone a role to play in thinking about responding to sexual violence in your community. And so it really strives to be rather inclusive in terms of the toolkit of skills and things that are taught. And so in that way, I think, can really kind of speak to those experiences. And I the bystander programs I know also, very much talk about all different kinds of people who experience victimization and how bystanders can really have the opportunity to step in to reduce the harm that people may be experiencing.
Okay. One of the things that you said way back at the beginning was about, or at least I thought you said, that I wanted to clarify was you were talking about campus assault. Is that defined simply as sexual assault? And you kind of said something about as opposed to intimate partner violence, or and I'm not clear on that, so I may be putting words in your mouth, but is campus assault, I mean, for example, when I was in college, I was married, and my husband and I were both students. If we had experienced domestic violence at that point, would that not have been considered campus assault? Would that have been a different category, or is that part of what we're talking about during campus assault as well?
So there are lots of different ways that interpersonal violence happens on campuses, right? So I think that's really what you're saying. And so I think that the term assault is really a much broader one that actually like could include like physical fights on a street or, you know, out in the community.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, sexual violence is what people sort of focus on. But I think increasingly people are talking about sexual assault, dating, domestic violence, and stalking on campus. And there are some really lots of prevention strategies are now trying to, you know, like bystander programs will talk about that array. So, for example, Green Dot talks about power-based personal violence, right, which would include all of those things. Bringing in the Bystander talks about the continuum of sexual violence, but also talks about how it intersects with dating violence, physical and emotional, and stalking and things like that. So I think that, you know, increasingly the research is clear that many of these things kind of co-occur, and that, you know, I think some of our prevention strategies may be able to intersect with these different issues. You know, for example, in the federal government, the Office on Violence Against Women has a campus program, a campus grants program, right? So campuses can get 3-year grants to really work on these issues. And the campus grant program, if you read their description, right, says that they're really working with campuses around sexual assault, dating, domestic violence, and stalking. And so, you know, those things are really considered as all kind of important things to be trying to create some change around.
What about services for victims and survivors? How are those on campuses? Are those adequate? Are they improving? Is it still an issue that people need to look at? What about services afterwards for victims?
So that's not my specific area of expertise. I mean, I do know from having been on campuses that the campuses I've been part of have really strong centers that do this. So, you know, is that campuses are really working on this. But I think it can happen in a number of different ways, right? So that it can happen by campuses building those resources right on campus. It can happen through partnerships with crisis centers that exist already out in the community. So I think it happens in a lot of ways, but, you know, it's definitely something that I think is on people's radar screen, and that, you know, campuses are really working to try to have those services available. But in terms of like the scope or the impact or any of that, like that's, I'm a researcher, not a practitioner or an advocate. So I know about people who are doing this work, and I really admire it so incredibly much, mm-hmm. and have been privileged to be on two campuses in my career, both at UNH and at Rutgers, that just have amazing centers that do prevention, but also that respond to survivors. And it's great that we have that.
Great. Tell us, we have just a few minutes left, but what's on the radar for you? What is your next research project in this arena?
So a major research project that I'm working on right now, or a question, I guess it's not a major project, but more of a big question that I'm working on with a student who's been in the doctoral program working with me, Liz Michella, and we've been looking at consequences. And so we've been trying to understand what happens after someone intervenes. So we see bystander intervention as a promising prevention practice. And so now we're trying to understand in a little more nuanced way, like, are bystanders safe by and large? Do they get positive feedback? Do they, Do they get hurt or retaliated against for trying to step in and help someone? I think before we fully embrace this as a form of prevention, we need to get a little more of an understanding of when it's helpful, how it's helpful, under what circumstances, the sort of what happens next kind of piece. And so that's one of the areas that I'm really interested in looking at.
Yeah, that sounds like a very interesting question to me, because culturally I think that we've gone through a period of a few decades where we as ordinary citizens are told, no, just call the authorities. Don't step in. Call the authorities. Call the authorities. But that seems to me that that kind of started shifting a little bit, I guess, way back after 9/11, where, you know, it was kind of like the ultimate bystander intervention when people on that airplane in Pennsylvania, you know, made it crash. And it seems to me there's been a little bit of a shift in that notion that you're not supposed to do anything, you just call the authorities. Is that my imagination, or have you seen something like that as well?
So in the way that we talk about bystander intervention in the programs that I've evaluated, those programs really take a broad approach. So they really take the approach that every situation and person and community is going to have a different toolkit that they're going to need. So it's really trying to give people the skills to kind of assess the situation and not do anything that will put themselves at risk, but to kind of think about what, you know, because a lot of times with prevention, like it's way before something has actually happened. It's, you know, when the risk is starting to escalate, and sometimes people have very creative distractions or things that they can do that that diffuse the situation so that it doesn't even rise to a certain critical danger level. And of course, you know, it's all a balance, right? Because in some communities, they have different perceptions of safety regarding law enforcement. And I think also there's the, do you need to call law enforcement all the time? Like sometimes maybe the situation is not really what you think it is, or, but I think that the beauty of bystander focused prevention is it starts those conversations, right? So that you're not just all of a sudden in a situation and not quite sure how to interpret it or maybe what to do. It really tries to anticipate a variety of situations that might crop up in one form or another, and then promote a toolkit so that you could say, oh, in this situation, I think maybe this is the thing that might help, but that might be different in a different situation.
Sure. And one of the things that I really like about bystander participation, bystander education, is the notion that, hey, you know what? We're all in this together. We're in this together. And I think that we live in a culture right now that we tend to feel very individual and very isolated, I think, in many cases. And when you feel that way, it's easy to say, well, you know, I see that happening over to that person over there, but I don't really feel any obligation that that has anything to do with me. So what I see in reading about bystander intervention programs is that, you know, we're all in this together. You know, we're all part of this big thing, and you can't just walk past without at least attempting to improve some sort of situation, no matter whether it be violence or whatever. Victoria, I know I asked you a lot of questions that weren't really in your bailiwick, but you responded very well from your experience and your expertise, and I appreciate that. I thank you so much for joining us, Victoria Banyard, for telling us what you know and what you've seen about campus assault. And thank you for listening to Three Women, Three Ways.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. Take care.